Hello, I'm Pete Peterson. You're listening to the Rabbit Room Podcast. This is part two of the Hutchmoot 2012 session titled The Art of Spiritual Subtext by Lanier Ivester and Sarah Clarkson.
All right. So moving from plot into character, this is a bit of a segue. So the character, I think, is where the real heart of the story comes to life, obviously. And we all know that what an author is asking of his readers is faith, that suspension of disbelief. And they create and present this character to you, but the minute that character does something that's out of character, the reader's going to lose faith. Sarah and I were laughing about it, that there's a great example in Our Mutual Friend, which, if y'all haven't read, please read.
In a Dickens novel.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dickens. But great book, but there's a character that is so endearing, so affable, so charming, so loving. His name is Mr. Boffin. And throughout the course of the story, he is corrupted by money. And then he hurts these people that are so dear to him, and it's just really painful, and says some awful things. But then at the end, he just kind of wraps it up that it was all a joke, and he was just testing them and trying to... Maybe Dickens just needed to wrap it up, but after 80,000 pages, I don't know. But I felt a little chipped, and I think everyone that I know that's read that book felt that way.
Yeah, didn't play true to character.
No, it did not. So we want to briefly discuss some of the characters in these two books and the ways that these spiritual values are inherent in these stories and how they're manifested in them. And I just want to mention that one thing that struck me so much about Brides Who Revisited is that the fact that man's reconciliation to God through the gospel is such a personal thing. It is so delicate. It is so beautiful and exquisite, but it is so private and very unique. And it is extremely difficult to portray this in an authentic fashion. And I think that's what really attracted me to Wall, is that he has such a light touch. And I think that's very respectful, and it's very effective. One of the similarities that we drew between these two books, there are couples in each of the books, Pilgrim's Inn and Brides Who Revisited, who are dealing with the same temptation of adultery. And the couple in Pilgrim's Inn handles it better than the couple in Brides Who Revisited. but it's really worth commenting on the similarities between them, that they're both searching for something through and beyond the other person. They both realize it at some point, and both of these affairs are broken off by the women in a finalizing of surrender to the lover of their souls, who's just been pursuing them through this whole story.
I can go ahead and talk about.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Okay. I was just going to say, too, about character. I know that there's a part of me that really doesn't identify with characters to whom spiritual things come too easily. Mm. And a lot of Christian novels that I've read, it feels like it's character has a good life, character has trouble, character submits to God or is converted and life is okay again. And I feel like that's not the narrative of real life. I would say the narrative of real life, and certainly my life, is more of Jacob struggling with God in the wilderness. And so when I think about characters that have really spoken to me about faith in novels, they're the characters who struggle, who doubt, but yet who continually move more and more forward towards grace. And something I love about Pilgrim's Inn, so I'll just give a brief sketch of the characters. The main family that comes from London to live in this Pilgrim's Inn on the river is the Elliot family, who are described as there were the brilliant and the beautiful Elliots, and there were the ugly Elliots. So you kind of were divided into the brilliant. You'd be brilliant and beautiful, you could be brilliant and ugly, or you could just be beautiful. But that was what it meant to be an Elliot. And so there's the Elliot family, and of them especially, there's a woman named Nadine. And she is one of the characters that really speaks a lot to me about this encounter with grace. And one of the first themes that you encounter in the novel is There's the other name for the Pilgrim's Inn is it's called the Herb of Grace, and it has a lot of folklore associated with it. It was the herb called rue, and the country name was the Herb of Grace. And so from the very outset, without ever saying a thing about anything explicitly spiritual, you have these people who are coming to live in a house of God where they're going to experience the Herb of Grace. Mm-hmm. And Nadine is a very passionate, artistic woman, and she has 5 children, and she's married to a man she doesn't love. And she's passionately in love with this other man named David, who is also part of the Elliot family. And a lot of the book is about her reconciliation. She's decided not to have the affair in the book that comes before this, but she hasn't given that up in her heart. And when she comes to the inn, she is not able to be at home until she confronts that thing that she's holding on to her into herself. And a lot of the book, as I was looking through the characters, I was realizing it's these characters only are allowed to become at home in the Pilgrim's Inn as they confront, as grace comes into their life, and they have to confront or repent from these things that they've brought to the house that are keeping them from coming fully home. And so I'm just going to read you a little bit, first about just the description that Googe gave of rue, which is the herb of grace, which I kind of thought was an interesting setting for the story. Because at the very first, as Nadine is first coming to the house, she's talking to a woman who has no reason to be happy. She's kind of a servant and very plain and has very little in life. And this woman says, "I'm happy, aren't you?" "No," said Nadine, pouring out her coffee. And they looked at each other, separated by that intangible barrier of a whole world of experience. "What is it that you haven't got, Nadine?" asked Margaret bluntly. "Some saving grace," said Nadine, "something that you have and I have not, some sort of astringency. I don't know what it is." And later on in the book, there's 2 characters talking about what that actually looks like. And this is what they say. "What exactly is the herb of grace?" asked Sally. "Why did the builders of a Pilgrim Inn call their house after it? Why in old days did the country people plant it in churchyards? And why is it growing in the wood beside a badger's holt? What is it?" And this is where I think Elizabeth Googe begins to answer it for us as well. "Well, obviously, something without which you can be neither a pilgrim nor a badger," said David, "nor get to heaven. The rue is a bitter-leaved herb. Herbs are astringent. Rue is repentance. Rue is compassion. Old Don Quixote was the knight of the rueful countenance, and he was a pilgrim, poor old chap." And so this is what this rue, this herb of repentance, which is really grace, of encountering something that calls them to get rid of the things that they're hiding, of the things that they're holding between them and full grace. And Nadine's story, as she lives in the house, she begins to encounter this, and she has to work through if she's willing to give up the things in her heart that keep her from grace. She's part of her being the home is a painter comes to paint her picture. And it says, she looked at the portrait. It was already to her inexperienced eyes well on the way to being finished. He had not spared her at all, and the youthfulness of the blue linen dress she wore was not echoed by the face above it. The lines above her, about her eyes, the gray in her hair, had been, if anything, accentuated. And now that he had spoken of them, she could see the sins and sorrows in her face. Yet he had given her a splendid beauty, a beauty that she did not think that she possessed. She was aware of her own loveliness, but there was something there, a sort of finality of beauty that she knew was not hers. "It's not quite right," she said. "No, I've gotten too far ahead in time. That happens sometimes, even in photography, you know. At the time it is taken, a photo is not a good likeness, yet 2 years later it is." "Well, why?" "There's a patient angel in us all, the spirit in the making, and he has 2 faces. He is the thing that you may be if you do this or that. Sometimes you see the one looking out of the window, sometimes the other." She looked at him with amusement. How ridiculously childish even the cleverest of men could be at times. "And this unattained beauty that you've given me?" "You'll attain it. The first time I saw you in the train, I said to myself, she's not at the height of it yet. It waits, that beauty, for the denial to give humor to the lips and gentleness to the eyes." "What denial?" "You know, or you should know, what needs cutting out of your own life. Some quite trivial thing, probably, but perhaps, no more than a reservation of thought, but it's enough." And so as she comes into this house, you know, and realizes what she's holding back, she begins to go through this process of being willing to finally lay down the thing that's keeping her from happiness, from her full ascent to her marriage, from the things that separate her from her children, and she encounters grace in the house in such a way that she's able to come fully home and be herself within it. Another character who comes to the house and encounters grace is a woman named Annie Laurie. And this is a woman who, from the first page, is described as having a shut-in look. And I think that for her, grace becomes, it reveals the deep things that she's hiding. And she has a very dark past, and she has a secret she's trying so hard to keep from each of the other people in the house. But as she's in this home, living in this place where she's unmasked, the secret has to come out. And it's her story of having that secret unmasked in which she finally finds the freedom to no longer carry guilt, to be at home within the inn of God. And the last character that I'll just talk about briefly is Ben. And he's the eldest son of Nadine. And he is a very, when he comes there, he's this very insecure, very unconfident boy who, he's 16, he wants to be an artist, but he is constantly self-doubting. And he comes, and this artist comes to live in the house and begins to tutor him. And as Ben lives in the home, he goes from this boy who has no identity to becoming first an artist, and then he becomes the host of the home. And he discovers this inner central beauty to the home that I'll talk about in the next part of our talk. But he becomes the one who takes on the identity of the host of this house. And as he encounters grace, grace gives him an identity. It strengthens him. And so I think that in these characters, for me, I just saw so many different aspects of what it means to come in contact with God, to repent from the things that hold us back, to have guilt put in a place where it can be absolved, to be given an identity of an artist and a host. There's just this beautiful picture of these characters as they come in contact with the house and the grace it offers that really expressed faith to me in a way that I could tangibly experience.
All right, well, just to light briefly on a few of the characters in Brideshead Revisited, I went back and forth. They were who I was going to talk about today. And of course, I want to talk about Charles. But since you see the story from Charles's perspective, it's definitely you get more insight into these other people, and you're observing him while he's observing these other people. The conversion of Charles is convincing because it's indivisible from his character. Like, you see him go through this whole process and all this conversations and all of these interactions, and then these heartbreaks that he goes through with these people that he loves, and it really is the plausible outcome of the searching and the longing that he's experienced from the beginning of the book. First, when he falls under the spell of Oxford itself, I mean, that just speaks a language of beauty to him that it will haunt him for the rest of his life. And there's some passages on Oxford that are just so gorgeous, but he says Oxford was a city of aquitaine. But then in his enchantment with his family, and first, you know, his friend Sebastian, and then later in his love affair with Julia. And so, like I said before, this outworking of divine purpose is so pervasive, but it is so subtle. And so you really see it more in the other characters that he's observing. You can get to the end of the book and go, did he get saved? Does he understand the gospel? But you know that he does. It's all there. It's there from the beginning. If you go back and look at the prologue, it's really interesting to compare. If you get to the end of the book and read the prologue again, there's a character who says to Charles at the beginning, as they're going around this property, he's been kind of scoping it out. It's one of his subordinates. Comes back to report, and he says, yeah, there's an RC chapel here, and, you know, it's more in your line than mine. Which, you know, when you realize what he's been through, that he actually, you know, has made that conversion. But of course, if you're reading it particularly from an American perspective, you're like, RC, is that like cola? Or but it was a Catholic chapel. One thing that I think is really significant about Charles is that he just always had this constant awareness of death and life, that kind of haunted by the fact that this world was not all there is. And in his dorm room in his rooms in Oxford, he has this skull. He has all this artwork, and he describes everything in his rooms, but he has this skull. And is it actually graven on the skull, Philip? Latin, et in Arcadia ego, or ego, that even in Arcadia, I am there. Like, that death is present, even in our happiest times, that this world is not all that there is. Moving on from Charles, though, I wanted to talk about Julia. She is, like I said, Sebastian's sister. She's the woman that Charles ends up having the affair with. And his descriptions of her, because it's in first person, it's so tender and so personal, and his descriptions of her are some of the most poignant and beautiful in the whole book. But Julia has grown up in the Catholic faith. She knows everything about God. She knows the gospel. She knows, you know, the Bible. But she ends up leaving the church to marry a divorced man, which in the Catholic tradition, that is, you cannot do and stay in the church. So she relinquishes all of this as a very young woman. You can see this tension in her because her father did the same thing. Which is a whole other story. But anyway, lots of things happen, and she and Charles are separated for 10 years. They weren't even in love at this point, or even attracted to each other. But 10 years later, they're thrown together in this extraordinary circumstance. And on the very cusp of this affair that they consent to fall into, Julia says, it's almost as if this were part of a plan. And I just think that that was such a striking moment in the story, because she recognizes it's not a sanction on what they're doing, like, oh yeah, God is letting them fall into this because he knows it's going to be okay, but that it's all part of a plan for our redemption, and that he's making use of everything. And she's almost haunted by this, that it's inevitable that she's going to have to acknowledge it. But there's one part of the book in one of her conversations with Charles, and the conversations in this book are just amazing. But Charles is telling Julia, they're already engaged at this point. They're in the midst of divorces of their other spouses and wanting to get married. But they were talking about Sebastian and Charles's friendship with him. And Charles says to Julia, Sebastian was the forerunner. And Julia says back to him, I've thought since, but perhaps I'm only a forerunner too. And then Charles kind of pulls back from this conversation. I think that's a very, very insightful moment into the subtext. But Charles pulls back in his narrative. Perhaps, I thought, while her words still hung in the air between us like a wisp of tobacco smoke, a thought to fade and vanish like smoke without a trace, perhaps all our loves are merely hints and symbols, a hill of many invisible crests, doors that open as in a dream to reveal only a further stretch of carpet and another door. Perhaps you and I are types, and the sadness which sometimes falls between us springs from disappointment in our search, each straining through and beyond the other, snatching a glimpse now and then of the shadow which turns the corner, always a pace or two ahead of us. One other character I want to mention before we move on to Image is Cordelia, and she's actually the youngest of this family, Sebastian and Julia, and then there's another brother, Bridie, and then Cordelia. But she is the only one who manages to hold on to her faith. I mean, Bridie does, but it's really more form for him. And Cordelia is the one that's just got the heart that you can just see is so redeemed. In fact, Charles describes her that there is no past tense in Cordelia's verb to love. And I just think that's very beautiful, and it says so much about her. Early in the book, she's describing her family to Charles, and she's a very precocious girl. She's just fresh out of this parochial school and has opinions on everything, and he's just a little bewildered by her. But she's talking about vocation and calling, and she says that her brother Sebastian has a vocation and he doesn't want it. He's running from it. Her brother Bridie wants a vocation and doesn't have it. And she says, I don't think I have a vocation either. And she really laments that she doesn't have a vocation, that she wanted to be a nun, but she doesn't have a vocation. She's not called. But But the irony and the beauty is that she does. She is like almost a priest in the midst of this family. She's the one who keeps their faith alight. And she's the only one for a while. It's like their faith goes into hiding. It's like a barbarian invasion. And she's the one that's, you know, keeping it alight. She embodies this flame that has been all but put out. One just brief passage. Long story, I won't go into it, but she's explaining to Charles what has become of his friend Sebastian. She's describing to Charles what has become of Sebastian in the years since they've met, and Sebastian's had a very long, kind of sad route to end up as a lay brother in this monastery in Morocco, and he's kind of a hanger-on. But anyway, she says that Sebastian is considered a very holy man, and Charles is very taken aback by that. And Charles is thinking, I thought of the joyful youth with the teddy bear under the flowering chestnuts. It's not what one would have foretold, I said. I suppose he doesn't suffer. Oh, yes, I think he does. One can have no idea what the suffering may be, maimed as he is. No dignity, no power of will. No one is ever holy without suffering. It's taken that form with him. I've seen so much suffering in the last few years. There's so much coming for everybody soon. It's the spring of love. And, you know, she all through the book, she's just dropping these hints and little revelations to Charles, almost with this smile like, I know you don't understand yet, but you will. So, one very, very brief comment I want to make about the comic characters in Bride's Head, and I only want to say this because they can be very off-putting, and a lot of people encounter them and go, this is not a very tasteful book. But they're there for a reason, and they're very, they're almost caricatures. They're very flat characters that are foils for the more fully developed characters. So if you do read Bride's Head, don't be turned off by them. Okay, on to imagery. If a symbol is something that is personally and traditionally understood and used to represent something else, an image is something that is lifted out of its ordinary usage, something out of its ordinary existence to express something otherwise inexpressible. So how can you use imagery in a story to portray the gospel? And, you know, it's very easy to think that it's a cop-out or you're not really telling me, but it is, it's extremely effective, and God does it for us all the time. Anyway, one of the ways that Wall does this is through conversations, the very meaningful conversations. And through the characters that he creates, you know. Sarah and I each pulled a few images out of our books that we'd like to share that we feel like the writers accomplished this very well. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm just going to say, too, about imagery, I remember reading a C.S. Lewis quote about when he read Fantasties, which is a novel by George MacDonald. And I thought I had it on here, but I guess I don't. Basically, what he said was he read Fantasties, which is this spiritual fairy tale. It is entirely set in fairyland, and it is odd, and you just read it and think, where have I gone? But he came out of it and said, you can't be too careful of what you read at that age, because he had an experience of what he called holiness. And he said that his imagination had been baptized by the imagery in this book. And I would say that when I went to read George MacDonald, I felt the same way, because when you read a George MacDonald book, you feel like you enter this land where you're just surrounded by images, whether it's fairyland images or trees or monsters or whatever. You kind of have this sense that they're communicating spiritual things to you. You feel like you're walking through spiritual ideas enfleshed in a landscape. And I think that imagery is a very powerful way to communicate truth within story. And it's one of the most powerful ways that I experience it for myself. And Lewis, when he was writing his Chronicles of Narnia, he started those books with images in his head, the image of a fawn with an umbrella in a snowstorm, the image of a great golden lion. And he said that it occurred to him that perhaps if he used these imageries, these images to clothe the gospel, he could get past the watchful dragons of all the atheists of life who had a a resistance to what he called the stained glass imagery of the church. He said, it's the same truth, but I'm giving it different imagery and different symbols, and I'm clothing it in a different way. And so I think that when I look at novels that have really impacted me deeply, the imagery is usually very strong and very communicative. And just also thinking of imagery. Oh, sorry, Siri. Siri and I do not get along well. The whole idea of imagery, there's a poem by George Herbert where he's talking about how something can become a window into the divine. And he says, teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see, and what I do in anything to do it as for thee. A man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth, through it pass, and then the heaven espy. And that, I think, is what good imagery in a Christian story should do, is it should be a window. It's not supposed to stay your eye. It's supposed to take you through it into a glimpse of heaven beyond. And so just quickly, because I know we're close to our time. Mm-hmm. I'll only read one passage, but I'm going to talk about, in Pilgrim's Inn, I think the house is a very strong image, this house of God in which people come to be redeemed by grace. She didn't have to tell the gospel. She just had to put in imagery. All of us long for a home. And in the story, this house, this medieval Pilgrim's Inn, was run by Cistercians. And so it's Ben, from the first day he walks in, he says, I feel like there's the spirit of a host here. And he's hosting the house. And one of the transformations of Ben is as Ben comes to try to paint what this host would have looked like. And I just think that image throughout the book of this beautiful home where they're called to be redeemed, and it's haunted by an invisible presence of a host who is laughing, who's welcoming them, who's drawing them in deeper into the beauty of the home. I mean, what a picture of the Holy Spirit working on our hearts, drawing us into the reality of grace. Part of that then is that, I'm sorry to give away a little bit of the book, but it's not a huge giveaway. Is halfway through the story, they discover in a pantry covered over by wallpaper that there's a medieval fresco on the wall, and that it was a chapel at the center of the house. And the chapel, they all come together to work on it and to restore the images that have been lost. And the chapel has an image that you're just going to have to read the book to find out. That really is, it's really symbolic of Christ. And I think that picture of all of them being drawn into this house, drawn deeper into it by this invisible host who's a spirit that laughs and welcomes them. And then right at the heart of the house, as if it was our own hearts that God draws us deeper into, where he's waiting to meet with us, they discover a chapel. And they discover this beautiful image that becomes the image that all of them realize is kind of the spirit of this house where they've been redeemed. And so I just think that that whole picture of being drawn into a home, being hosted, and then drawn right to the inner room where we're waiting to meet the Redeemer of all, I think that is the most beautiful image. And I think those images are so strong in this book. And yet it's not a book that would ever be put on the Christian fiction shelf. It's not a Christian fiction book. I can rarely find it anywhere to begin with. But but yet it's a book that has so deeply affected my faith and shown me what it means to be drawn and wooed by God, to be brought in, to be brought home in a way that very few other stories ever have. And I'll close my bit by saying, and I'll let you close in a minute, but I think that when I really think about fiction and about stories that embody faith, I think they ought to be the same thing that the Pilgrim's Inn actually is. I think that Googe created a picture of what the writer does as well. It's create a house. And, you know, as an author of faith, any house I create is going to be haunted by that Holy Spirit who's drawing people deeper in. And my hope is that in a story I tell, and in any good story that embodies faith, that the reader will meet Christ at the heart of it. And so I just think creating that Pilgrim's Inn is such a picture of what I long for in a good Christian story and what I hope to embody in my own work. And it's that re-enchantment of a disenchanted world. It's that meeting God right where I least expected it. So mm-hmm. That's what I hope for stories and hope to write in the future. So.
Yeah. All right. The imagery of Bride's Head is very pervasive too, and I just want to pull a couple out just to note this just craftsmanship. But there's an image, and it's not as present, I guess, through the whole book is the image of the house, but there's this image that Charles has in his own head of this cabin, and it's right when you can tell he's had this conversation with Cordelia that is very probing, very, very, it just, hits him in a way that he begins to feel uncomfortable. You can see he's just starting to get unnerved, like it's like a chink in the armor. And it says, "That night I woke in the darkness and lay turning over in my mind the conversation with Cordelia. How I had said, you knew I would not understand? How often it seemed to me I was brought up short, like a horse in full stride, suddenly refusing an obstacle, backing back from the spurs, too shy even to put his nose at it and look at the thing. And then another image came to me of an Arctic hut and a trapper alone with his furs, an oil lamp and log fire, the remains of supper on the table, a few books, skis in the corner, everything dry and neat and warm inside, and outside the last blizzard of winter raging and the snow piling up against the door. Quite silently, a great weight forming against the timber, the bolt straining in its socket, minute by minute in the darkness outside, the white heap sealing the door, until quite soon, when the wind dropped and the sun came out on the ice slopes and the thaw set in, a block would move, slide and tumble, high above, gather weight, till the whole hillside seemed to be falling, and the little lighted place would crash open and splinter and disappear, rolling with the avalanche into the ravine." And, it's a pretty violent image. He uses this very self-reliant picture of this snug, well-lighted place, this little hut that's all provisioned, at first is being unknowingly threatened, and then you can kind of hear the crack of the avalanche. And it is just this beautiful picture of the totality of Charles's conversion and the fact that he realizes if he does surrender, it's going to have to be everything. That it is not a, yeah, I'll take this and I'll take some of that too. It's, if he comes to Christ, he lays down his life. Everything else is just obliterated. And it was interesting because Wall was criticized for making his characters worse off after they came to the faith than otherwise, but he was really unapologetic about that. He was like, if we can't be all or nothing, he just really wanted to illustrate that forsaking all and coming to Christ. And so that sense of obliteration is just very, very effective. The very end, and I really shouldn't even read the last line in the book, but I'm going to, just to show you what happens to Charles, and you'll recognize it. The avalanche was down, the hillside swept bare, the last echoes died on the white slopes, the new mound glittered and lay still in the silent valley. And, you read that and go, yeah, it doesn't say, and then I bowed my head and prayed and received Christ. Like, but he held nothing back. And so I think that's very effective. Another image is of the lamp in the sanctuary. And the bride's head estate is the centuries, generations been the seat of this family, the March Main family. And the chapel on their property is very central to their faith, and the sanctuary and the lamp is the life of it. And of course, the lamp signifies the presence of Christ. When the lamp is blown out in a sanctuary, the glory has departed. And so when one of the characters, the mother matriarch figure, dies, the chapel is shut up, the priest is dismissed, the lamp is blown out. And Cordelia tells Charles that it was as though from now on it was always to be Good Friday. And he had no idea what she was talking about, but which I think is so beautiful, because at the end of the book he comes back in the epilogue after you've watched him experience all of this and know that he's come to the faith. So he comes back to the requisition bride's head. He finds that the chapel has been reopened, that a priest has been instated implicitly by Julia herself, and that most importantly of all, that the lamp has been relit. In the midst of all the moral squalor of the war and the age that he finds himself in, the ruin of his own life, and it's quite ruined, he is filled with hope. And it's so buoyant that someone else comments on the change of his countenance when he comes out of the church. And it just does fulfill that hope that, as Wall promised in his preface, that the human spirit redeemed can survive all disasters. And just in closing, to me, the beautiful metaphor of Brideshead as a writer is at the very, very end of the epilogue, and when he's gone into the sanctuary and seen the lamp again, He's walking back across, hearing all the sounds of the bugle and the cookyard and all these things, just zoo noises that just don't belong in this beautiful world that he's known. And he begins to think that the builders did not yet know the uses to which their work would descend. They made a new house with stones of the old castle. Year by year, generation after generation, they enriched and extended it. But something quite remote from anything the builders intended has come out of their work, and out of the fierce little human tragedy in which I played. Something none of us thought about at the time, a small red flame, a beaten copper lamp of deplorable design, relit before the beaten copper doors of a tabernacle. The flame which the old knights saw from their tombs, which they saw put out, that flame burns again for other soldiers far from home. It could not have been lit but for the builders and the tragedians, and there I found it this morning, burning anew amid the old stones. And I just love that image of the labor of artists not knowing the end of their work, that you cannot foresee the weary, war-torn souls who are going to encounter that lamp and who will lift their eyes to it and have their faith rekindled or kindled in the first place. And to me, that really settles the question of whether I set out to tell the gospel or allow it to breathe and whisper and reveal itself in every line, in every phrase, to allow the Spirit to just blow his wind into the sails of that story and carry it where he will. So
go read Brideshead Revisited and Pilgrim's Inn. Thank you.
For more information regarding the songs, writers, and artists featured here, please visit rabbitroom.com. Rabbit Room music composed and performed by Ben Shive.